I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Paul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're here to shine a light on some surprising and inspiring places and what we can learn from them.
Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Richard Kagoy. Coming up on this edition of Focus on Africa. What do ordinary Ivorians make of former leader Laurent Gbagbo's presidential bid? Last time round, he refused to concede defeat, sparking a civil war.
I don't think he's a strong opponent for the party in office.
Laurent Gbagbo should have trained and hardened someone from his political party, a new and young leader.
After the recent internet outage in Africa, we find out how the internet travels across oceans in superfast cables.
The cables that carry the internet around the world vary quite a lot, depending on a whole lot of technical specificities. But basically, they are fiber optic cables that are about as thin as a human hair. And those are the technology that actually carries the internet, you know, 10,000 kilometers at a time.
Plus, how are some artists affected by economic wars? We hear from Ghanaian Afrobeats artist Kwame Eugene. It's Friday, the 22nd of March. Let's begin in Ivory Coast, where former President Laurent Gbagbo is reported to have agreed to be his party's presidential flag bearer in elections scheduled for October next year. Mr. Gbagbo refused to concede defeat in the 2010 election, leading to a civil war that left 3,000 people dead, dozens injured, and even a greater number internally displaced or refugees. He was acquitted of war crimes charges by the International Criminal Court a decade later. Now he's back, and he wasted no time in setting up a new political party known as the African People's Party, Côte d'Ivoire, in 2021. Abdon Bayeto is the new party's deputy secretary general in charge of all things relating to the party's external representation and diaspora affairs. Abdon, what are Mr. Gbagbo's chances of taking up the top post again, given the fact that quite a number of people still believe that he could have saved the country from violence, you know, from death and destruction, had he accepted the results way, way back then?
But I mean, Richard, when you say that, it's very surprising. Everybody who goes to an election to win. In 2010, we are not going to make the history again. But Gbagbo did win the election.
Don't you think possibly, you know, there could be a section, there could be a constituency within, you know, Ivory Coast that still hold on to this perception and that possibly could shape how, you know, the decisions in terms of who they rally behind when it comes to the ballot. And that possibly could, to a certain extent, diminish Mr. Gbagbo's chances.
Let's take to the fact that in 2010, Laurent Gbagbo was the man who organized the election in Côte d'Ivoire. He went beyond our constitution and he took the Article 49 for Alassane to be able to be candidate. Now, with Gbagbo at The Hague, Alassane was able to be a president of the country. 2015, he had a candidate in front of him, was Afiyen Gesan. In 2020, he had another candidate in front of him, Kakabe. If we want to rerun the election of 2010, it's for Alassane to be ready to accept Laurent Gbagbo as a candidate and for the two to run as we did history. What happened in 2010? They had a debate, political debate on TV, and to rerun it again. Then we see who's got the value of the country in 2010 and who could run, you know, to be the president of the country. So it's so simple. Let them go back for 2025 and rerun the electoral issue of 2010. Then, you know, we could decide of what electoral constituency could talk about. But before that, it's difficult to say if we don't both go to the election. That's what I could tell you.
All right, so let's fast forward from 2010 to 2024. So Mr. Gbagbo has been chosen by your party as a presidential candidate for next year's election. Just describe this to me. Has he been listening to the people? What kind of conversation is he having? Let's just head to the streets of Abidjan and just listen to what people are saying there in the streets. Let's just have a listen.
I think Laurent Gbagbo has great ideas and was definitely a key leader in Ivory Coast despite the rebellion and the war. I think the Ivorian people are still traumatized, and Gbagbo, although he's trying to get back into the political scene, I don't think he's a strong opponent for the party in office, if the party in office runs again. I think if he wants a shot at winning, he would have to convince Simon Gbagbo, Blaise Gudé and Afin Gesan to join him.
The announcement of Laurent Koudou Gbagbo comes as no surprise for those who follow Ivorian politics. We remember that when he came back, he expressed a commitment to remain in politics until his death. Now the question is, the guy got a pardon, but not an amnesty. Is the incumbent president going to let him run?
As far as I'm concerned, Laurent Gbagbo should have trained and hardened someone from his political party, a new and young leader who will be able to confront Alassane Ouattara, because everybody knows that Alassane Ouattara will cling to power next year. He will be a candidate to election in 2025.
All right, mixed reactions there. But then, Abdon, what is your reaction, especially on the issue that even though that Mr. Gbagbo has been allowed to participate in politics in Ivory Coast, he's been complaining that his civic rights have not been restored and that 20-year sentence of the courts in Ivory Coast is still on record, and that could, well, ban him from contesting?
That's why we said that our first issue here is for us to fight to have his name on the electoral list. We're going also to fight for the president of the Electoral Commission to be somebody who will be a patriot in the country, not somebody who will be coming for a political party. I heard that young lady said that Alassane was going to, you know, run the election and try and win it. But this time in 2025, it won't be 2010 or 2015 or 20. It will be 2025. And let's have it a fair run election in Cote d'Ivoire. And I'm sure they will see the winner of 2010 will be the winner of 2025. And it will be Laurent Gbagbo.
So just picking up from one of the speakers there in the streets of the capital, Abidjan, bringing up the issue about the age factor. They're talking about getting someone who's younger and not Mr. Gbagbo, in who is in his 80s, while another voice says Mr. Gbagbo should then join forces with members of his former party. What's your response to that?
I'm sure for electoral issue, Laurent Gbagbo, as the president of a party, is going to speak to the opposition. He will speak to them. That's a must. He will come to a stage where Simon Gbagbo, Laurent Gbagbo, Blaise Gudé, everybody will sit down and see the way forward. And I'm sure it will come to that. The second thing I'm talking about, the youth, a young person of Laurent Gbagbo, that's not Laurent Gbagbo to decide. That's the party. That's the party who decide who should be the person who's take after Laurent Gbagbo. At the moment, the party has decided Laurent Gbagbo. Let's stay with this. And then the rest, we see what the party will decide. And we do believe that the right winner of 2010 will be also the winner of 2025.
Abdon Bayeto, a spokesman for former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo, who's planning to run for the country's top post. A widespread internet outage that affected parts of Africa recently caused major disruptions. This was due to damages to vital undersea cables that has left users with major connectivity issues in several countries in West and Central Africa. Experts say it could take weeks, if not months, to fix it. Let's delve into the complexities of repairing undersea fiber optic cables. For expert insights, I called up Jess Auerbach-Jahajia, an associate professor at the University of Cape Town's Graduate School of Business and author of an upcoming book on fiber optic cables and digital connectivity.
The cables that carry the internet around the world vary quite a lot, depending on a whole lot of technical specificities. But basically, they are fiber optic cables that are about as thin as a human hair. And those are the technology that actually carries the internet, you know, 10,000 kilometers at a time. But those thin little hairs are encased in a few layers of protective material. There's some copper to conduct the electricity. There's usually some kind of plastic to protect it. And depending on where the cable is and the kinds of marine environment that it's going through, it might have various layers of cladding. But basically, it is just a few fiber optic pairs. There are always two of these thin threads that work kind of as a team. And depending on the capacity of the cable, like you have bigger ones and smaller ones, and some of the linking technology, you may have as few as 8 fiber optic threads, or you might have as many as 30.
That's really fascinating, because most of us have just seen, the cables, and especially when they're landing on the shore. In terms of repairs, because whenever we're having sort of like a cut, how does that happen? Mm-hmm. Who does the fixing? How does that go about?
Again, it depends on where the repair happens. So if a cable breaks close to the shore, then sometimes the repairs are done by divers and teams with specialist equipment who can retrieve it from the shore environment. But more frequently, the cables break in the deep sea. And then what's needed are these crews from specialist ships who have a whole lot of really sophisticated technical equipment. And they go and retrieve the cable, sometimes with submersibles, sometimes with other technological devices. And occasionally they also use divers to help them. And they bring the cable up onto the ship in the middle of the ocean, and then they do the repair on board in most cases.
So how would you say that differs from the traditional cable repairs that happen on land?
I think one of the big ways in which it differs is on land, if a cable breaks, it's pretty easy for an internet service provider to figure out where it's broken and then go. And sometimes they might have to dig up some asphalt, but it's generally not a very complicated process to find the break and then repair it. But when you're working undersea, you've got to factor in marine conditions. So you often have oceanic currents. You have to get the cable up, sometimes from a depth of maybe more than a kilometer underwater. And you've got to work with a system that is carrying a live current between continents. And so there's a whole lot of additional factors that have to be considered. The power of the vessel's engines to be able to hold steady while the repair is being done. And there's a whole number of different things that then have to be taken into account, as well as the fact that when you're on land, you have all sorts of backup and other teams and people can come and support. But when you're doing a repair at sea, it's generally just a crew of between 50 and 60 people who are working together in nonstop shifts to be able to ensure the repair is done as quickly and as safely as possible.
So how do you detect if there's been a damage or a cut on the cable somewhere in the deep sea?
So the cable, the fiber optic threads, just carry pulses of light. And that's actually the internet. It's quite incredible technology. And what happens is when those pulses stop transmitting properly, it's possible to detect and usually localize quite accurately where the fault has taken place. And that's done through some sophisticated measuring techniques where you have stations on land that transmit signal, say from Angola to Brazil, for example, they're transmitting signal across the South Atlantic cable system. And at those spaces, you can then measure how long it takes to send one individual piece of light roaring across the ocean from Angola to Brazil. And if there's a change in the time that it takes for the signal to land on the other side, depending on what that time difference is, you can then fairly accurately figure out where the break has taken place.
And what really causes damage to the subsea internet cables, just typically?
Sure. So typically, the cables are most vulnerable on shore. So the closer you are to human activity, the more likely you are to find that a cable is maybe snagged in an anchor of a boat, or perhaps some kind of marine traffic affects it. But they're also very vulnerable to oceanic shifts. In the same way that we have your weather systems on top of the ocean, there's a lot that happens underneath the water in terms of the movement of geological systems, in terms of seismic activity, and many other factors. So quite often the cables break for natural causes as well. For example, this most recent break is likely seismic activity off Côte d'Ivoire. But last year, Africa suffered some pretty significant breaks as well. And those were rockfall in the Congo River Kenyan, and that does happen from time to time. So it's a variety of kind of human and non-human entities that can cause these cables to break. But if you think of them, they're very, very small. The ones in the deep sea are almost like the hose pipe you have in your garden. So these are tiny threads that are linking the continents. And in certain ways, they are quite fragile, because to make them less fragile would be incredibly expensive given the distances involved. So they are quite vulnerable. But at the same time, they don't break all that often, if you imagine how much activity is actually going on. Average lifespan of a cable at present is about 25 years, but increasingly we're finding that there are technologies that allow the extension of cable life, and so they can be upgraded. And in some cases, cable systems are upgraded, and in other cases, they're retired.
I read somewhere that in 2023, you bought a ship that was responsible for maintenance of most of Africa's, you know, undersea and network. What was that experience like? What did you see? What really happens?
The vessel is called the Leon Thevenin. It's a really fantastic piece of engineering and technical mastery. It's the ship that repairs most of Africa's internet, as you say, and maintains a lot of our cable infrastructure. And I was able to spend a week on board documenting and to some extent participating in a repair that happened off the coast of Accra in Ghana. It was a really interesting experience to be on board, because there's so many things that stood out. But part of it was just the incredible coordination required to retrieve the cable safely, to repair it, and then to place it back in the ocean, and the incredible dedication of the crew, everybody from the ship steward, cooks, the people who actually do the fiber optic repair, the ship engineers who have to hold the vessel through these often quite challenging oceanic environments. But the way people work together and the dedication that the crew demonstrated, very much with clear understanding that people's digital connectivity depended on their ability to work well as a group.
What really can be done to minimize the risk of a future, you know, cable damages, and also mitigate, you know, the impact it does have on African connectivity?
Great question. So part of that is about having more cable systems in place. So one of the challenges in the West African scenario that we've seen last week is that some of the countries affected only have one spur that connects them from the main fiber optic line to the global internet. And depending on whether or not those countries have good terrestrial network systems as well, they then sometimes become very vulnerable to internet breakages. So whereas a country like South Africa or Nigeria, for example, has a lot more fiber optic cables that come up to land in these countries. And so when something happens to one cable system, it's quite easy to reroute internet traffic. The same way, if there were an accident on a highway, you can reroute traffic on an alternative route. But that's only possible if you have the alternative route in place. So in the industry, they call it redundancy. So you've got to have a whole lot of different pathways available to ensure that the internet keeps flowing.
And what sort of collaboration takes place in terms of maintaining and also repairing some of these cables? Because then I guess it's not just the responsibility of sort of like a preserve of one country, but then this goes beyond a region, presumably even a continent, and, you know, just working with different players from around the world.
Yeah, that's a good observation. So part of what makes this all quite complex is that the cable infrastructure is huge. I mean, it's big physically, but it's also legally very complex, because often, as you observe, there are multiple countries who have stakes in a given cable. But also increasingly, we're seeing a shift where global corporations such as Alphabet or Meta or Huawei from China are investing in the physical infrastructure of the internet. And so the legal agreements that govern how these cables are managed and maintained and what happens in a situation of a break, for example, are often very dense and very complex, and they include a huge number of different people. And so it's quite difficult for one national government, for example, to be able to say, well, I'm going to call the shots on how the internet works in my country. Because as you observe, these are global systems. And at the moment, most of the money for investments in digital infrastructure is coming either from China or from the United States. And that poses a whole lot of really interesting questions around the wiring of the African continent. Some people refer to it as a kind of neo-digital colonialism. But at the same time, this is something that nobody would ever say we don't desperately need.
Maybe just as a follow-up to something that you've just raised here, when you talk about a neo-digital colonialism, What do you really mean?
So this is a notion that is coming out of academia at the moment, and basically saying, if we think of data as the new oil, how do countries around the world govern the flow of data from their citizens? Because at the moment, many countries across Africa aren't able to negotiate on equal terms and really ensure that what's being implemented really works for their own citizens. And we see this with Cambridge Analytica case in the Kenyan elections in 2008, for example. And this has been going on for a while. And I think rightly, some people are quite concerned.
I found this really conversation to be quite illuminating. So some of us were consumers and we're in the downstream end of things. We never really appreciate what it takes to connect us to the rest of the world. So Jess, thank you so much for your time. It was great really having you on the podcast.
Thanks very much, Richard. Have a good day.
Jess Auerbach Jahajia. Ghana was recently rated by a reputable finance media company as having the third worst performing currency in Africa this year after the Nigerian Naira and Egyptian Pound. We've discussed the causes and possible solutions of the economic wars the West African country is facing on this podcast, but how does it affect the creative community? That's the question we put to Afrobeats artist Kwame Eugene. He's known as a great songwriter and has garnered over 100 million online streams for his numerous songs, which often center on love and give his listeners an opportunity to dance and have fun. But how does he acknowledge the difficulties most of his fans at home are facing when making a song?
We're still growing economically. So in various areas, we're not 100% there. I think that's the reason why these demonstrations and strikes and all are happening in the country. But I think we're still going. We're still growing and we're learning. And we're putting things together because Ghana, 5-10 years ago, is not the Ghana we see today. Yeah. There have been some growth and I'm very happy about that. And for the fact that people go on strikes and people do demonstrations, that's why I love to talk about hope as well. Because no matter the situation, you need to have some kind of hope as a backbone for you to get up every morning and keep going. One thing I love to do is to observe what's going on in the economy. I mean, what's going on in the whole world. And I'll put together something I think people want to hear. It's either something they can have fun with, some sound they can enjoy with, or something they can sit all by themselves and help them reminisce, or something that's about the societies. I always need to put content out there that speaks something. It's not just beats and goofy lyrics. Because sometimes I want to put message out there that gives people hope. Speak about hope as well. And regardless, no matter how much we work, we need to make some time to have fun as well, because all work and no play. So, happy music, candy music.
One of the issues which has captured public attention is the All Africa Games in Ghana. The games have trended on social media for days, with many Ghanaians commenting on what they see as poor organization of the event. Kwame performed at the opening ceremony of the games and tells us, in spite of the controversy, the games are beneficial to the country.
Okay, so we got a call in the label that we need Kwame on this show. And of course, I'm always excited to do something that represents Ghana. And if not me, the champions high life. I think who else? It was a big privilege. And I think the whole of Africa was around. Someone representing someone from every part of Africa was around. And I had to do my best as a Ghanaian as well. And it was my part to be involved in the All African Games. For the entertainment side, we get to showcase what we have, our kind of music, which is highlight music, to the rest of the Africans. And it brings a lot of revenue to the country. Businessmen get to make a lot of money, fixing all these stadiums, and it's the buzz we get as Ghanaians for the All African Games being held in our nation. The buzz comes with the jobs, it comes with connections. There's actually a lot.
Awesome. Yeah.
Now, we met with Kwame in a makeshift studio here in London where he was making a new song. We took the opportunity to find out about the various indigenous influences which he draws on when composing a track.
100% highlife music. Because I grew up listening to legends like Daddy Lumba, Amachi Dede Kodwenchi, Osibisa. There's some influence from these people in my music. With the help of TikTok and Instagram views right now, music can actually travel in a very short pace. You know, you can get it to almost everywhere in the world. Even if you're somewhere in some corner in some village in Ghana. That's what TikTok is doing right now. Now it's all about content creation. That's all we need right now. So if there's a dance to your song and you have half of Nigeria dancing to it. Eventually, it pops up on everybody's feed. And all of a sudden, it looks like this song is a big song, because when I go here, I hear it. When I move here, when I scroll up, I hear it. So all of a sudden, it sounds like, okay, this is a big song. That's how come we get these invitations that, oh, there's an O2 show. We want to have you on for this fee. Because they've sent us on TikTok, even though they live in the UK. You need to look at the public, what they really want to hear. Okay. Sometimes it'll be a popular phrase at that moment that everybody's talking about. Right now, it's We Know Gogri. And that's what every African is jumping on right now. If you can write a song with We Know Gogri and it works, that's all for you. You happen to be the leader. And we all have to move away from We Know Gogri because it's a big song. Find your own face, find your own tag. And two, it needs to come with a dance now. The entertainment industry is growing big in Africa now, because dancers are making waves as much as musicians right now. So you can have a good song, but you will need a good dancer to put together some beautiful routine that everybody can do. Shout to Champion Roli from DWP all the way in Ghana. I came up with a song and I put some bits in there that can turn on TikTok. And some words I know people want to hear, and they put smiles on people's faces in there. And it was up to Champion Roli to create something that everyone can do. So he created something and it really worked.
There have, however, been concerns about the recent passing of Ghana's anti-LGBTQ law and statements of support for the bill made by various politicians on the issue. Will this not affect the reception of his music?
Music right now, it's about putting the content you have out there. So your idea may be different from whatever is going on in the country at that moment, and it can still work. Because, like I said earlier on, TikTok is not just about your country. TikTok is for the whole of the world. So long as you can put together a content that pleases the world, I think you're okay. You don't need a bill from the parliament to affect your music. Do you get it? So long as you can have something that the world can jump on, it's okay for you.
Afrobeats artist from Ghana, Kwame Eugene. Thanks for listening to this edition of Focus on Africa. This podcast was put together by Victor Silva and Daniel Dadzi in London. Paul Bachbinga was in charge, and Johnny Hall is our technical producer. Andrew Lombard and Alice Modengi are our editors. Remember to check out our sister podcast, Africa Daily. It's a deep dive into one new story shaping the continent. Find it on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Kagoye. Have a lovely weekend.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. My award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, collecting letters from listeners from all over the world, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. And I'm joined by some very special guests, sharing their experiences and words of wisdom too. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.